Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Yay. All persons have any business before the Honorable Beverly Canody, Justice of the Norfolk Superior Court, before the County of Norfolk. Join Nia, give your attendance, and shall be heard. Let's see the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is now open. You may be seated.
All right, good morning, counsel. Good morning, Ms. Reed. Good morning, jurors.
Good morning. Good morning.
I do have to ask you those same three questions. Were you all able to follow the instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone since we were last here on Friday?
Yes.
Everyone said yes and nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to follow the instructions and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left on Friday?
No.
And were you all careful? Everyone said no or shook their heads. Were you all careful with your social media this weekend?
Yes.
Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Brennan.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Commonwealth will call Ian Whiffen.
Okay. All right, just come on up.
Commonwealth calls Ian Whiffen.
Face our clerk and raise your right hand. You swear to your phone, the evidence you give to the court and jury in the case down here should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
May I, Your Honor?
Yes, please.
Good morning, sir.
Good morning.
Would you kindly introduce yourself to the jury?
Yes, my name is Ian Whiffen. I'm a digital forensics examiner and decoding product manager for Cellbrite.
You just mentioned Cellbrite. Is that where you work?
It is, yes.
And you're a forensic examiner?
I am.
Can you tell us a little bit about Cellbrite, where you work?
Yes, Cellbrite provides digital forensic solutions to customers globally for access and decoding of digital artifacts from devices.
Where would you find a digital system? Is that resigned to a phone or is it all systems?
Typically, Cellbrite focuses on phones or iPads, but we do have some additional devices that we can also integrate, computers, vehicles, things like that.
So simply, what is Cellbrite?
Cellbrite is a digital intelligence company.
Do they use a certain type of software? Do they brand a certain type of software?
Yeah, we create our own software to access devices and to decode the data that we pull from devices.
So essentially, does that software help you look into the data in a phone and analyze it?
It does, yes.
What is the role of a digital forensic analyst?
Typically, the analyst would take the data that's been extracted from a device, such as a cell phone, process that in software such as a physical analyzer that Cellbrite create, and use that information to filter, to search, and to create a report for the investigator that would allow them to see what happened on the device at the time being investigated.
How long have you been involved in analyzing data, sir?
I started my career in digital forensics in 2013.
Can you take us back to the beginning of your career and tell us a little bit about how you became involved in learning about analyzing data?
Certainly. I spent 5 years as a frontline police officer in the UK during the 2000s. In 2009, immigrated to Canada and continued policing frontline officer in Calgary before joining the digital forensics team in 2013. Pursued several qualifications related to digital forensics and just continued in that role until 2020, when I left the police agency and began working for Cellbrite.
While you were working at the police agency and began your career analyzing data, were there special classes that you took?
There were. In order to be a forensic examiner in Canada, you have to take a 3-week foundational course in Ottawa, basically covering the basics of digital forensics. And then from there, other courses are available that would focus on things like cell phones, would focus on how to get data from different types of devices. And then there's industry qualifications that can be sought as well, where you can focus on particular types of device or particular types of data.
Does software in this field continually change?
It does. Every time an update is released to an application or to an operating system, there's the opportunity for the foundation of that software to change. And from a forensics point of view, you have to re-understand what has changed, make sure you understand what is now happening on that device, and provide that information to the users.
As you've progressed through the field, do you continue to take classes?
I've not taken a class now since I actually joined Cellbrite and did the basic foundational courses that Cellbrite offer. But prior to that, I was doing courses across the industry.
Do you teach courses?
I do teach webinars. I don't teach any actual courses, although some of my research and some of my tools are taught to examiners in many of the industry standard qualifications which users seek.
Do you ever write papers about the subject that are published?
I do. So I have a blog where I publish my research. Sometimes some of those become papers which get peer-reviewed and distributed in more academic channels.
So when one of your papers is peer-reviewed, can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, essentially, other forensics examiners would read over the paper that I've written, do their own testing, compare their testing and research to what I've conducted, and make sure that what I've said is consistent with their findings. And presuming that what they find is the same as what I found, then they would agree that it's a valid document and it gets shared.
Take us now to Cellbrite. When you began working at Cellbrite, what did you do?
When I started there, I was considered the senior digital intelligence analyst. My role was to help the developers of the software understand the role of a digital forensics examiner, what an examiner needs from the tool, what an examiner wants to do with the tool, and how they want to use it. And then since then, I've progressed to the decoding product manager, where I can manage the backlog of software applications that we support, decide how we should support those applications, and how that information should look to the users.
Do you do research?
I do still do research, yes. It's not my primary function within Cellbrite, but it's something that I've continued to do throughout my career.
Have you ever done any programming?
Yes, again, I'm not an official programmer with Cellbrite, but I do program as well, and I have several tools which I've written myself for the last few years, since around 2015, tools that I wrote to do the things that the vendor tools didn't do, and to offer examiners things that the vendor tools didn't offer. And I continue to maintain those tools as a learning opportunity for myself, and also because other examiners can make use of these same features.
Mr. Whiffen, have you ever testified in court regarding forensic examination of data?
I have, yes.
And can you share a little bit about that?
I've been qualified as an expert in Canada, Australia, the UK, in total around 20 times.
I want you to take us now to the Cellbrite software. We talked a little bit about it. I don't want to go into too much detail, but can you help us explain how software works, like Cellbrite software?
Yes, so fundamentally, when we've got data from a device, it's a series of files, a series of databases, property lists, all manner of different structured data. The software that we create knows where these files exist, knows how to read these files and what the data inside them means, and provides a clear view for the user to view that data. As an example, if you were to look at the SMS database on a device, all you would see is a long list of messages that don't really have an easy way to interpret or to read them. Our software takes that information, converts it into a conversational view so that as a user, you can read the data, you can see who sent what message, what time it was sent. We can do decoding and decryption of various different types of security to give the user as much information as possible.
Is there other software available in addition to Cellebrite?
There is. There's multiple vendor supplied tools and multiple tools available that are maintained by users in the community, like myself.
Does a forensic examiner, should they rely simply on the software program, or is there more to do other than the program itself?
The software program is great at finding the data and displaying the data, but I always maintain it's the role of the examiner to actually understand what that data means and provide context and validation for what that data means, making sure that the end user of the report, whether that's the investigator, a judge or a jury, can understand what that data actually means rather than just taking it at face value from the software.
Does the software create a report that you can look at that manages or arranges some of the data that you can see?
It does. It just creates a list of all of the results that the examiner wants to include in the report.
So the software can produce a report, but the examiner goes beyond the report and looks into the data itself?
The examiner can and should go beyond what the program provides.
Let's turn now to your involvement in this case. Can you share with us when you first became aware of the data in this case and how that came about?
Yes, it was actually one of the public relations managers at Cellebrite who reached out to me or to my team because he'd heard about this case and about the confusion regarding a timestamp and requested if we could look into it and find out what the confusion was and how we could respond to it. At that point, I contacted the investigators to get more details.
Did you learn that a consumer had called about a question relative to a report produced by the software?
Yes, there was both the troopers who had requested information about this particular artifact and also a private forensics examiner, Richard Green.
And when Richard Green reached out to your company, what specifically was the question or issue?
He reached out to the tech support team, asking basically, there's a timestamp that doesn't make sense. I need to understand what this timestamp means.
What is a timestamp?
Essentially, it is the time which is attributed to an artifact. So it should intentionally be when something happened on that device, we would show a timestamp associated to it.
Can you tell us what an artifact is?
An artifact would be any piece of data that we pull from that device. So it could be a text message, it could be a location point, it could be a photograph.
So if I had photographs on my phone, would each photograph be considered an artifact?
It would, yes.
Would the date and time I took the photograph be considered an artifact?
I'd consider that a property of the artifact.
And if I had a phone call or a text message, those would be considered artifacts?
Yes.
When I look at my phone and I see a call log or a name, does that tell me all the information about that call?
When you look on the phone itself?
Yes.
No, there's usually a lot more information in the background of the phone that's available to the forensics examiner, which the user wouldn't necessarily see on the device.
And so when you're looking at an artifact, a phone call, a text message, whatever it may be, and you see it on a report, if you want to know more detail, where it came from, when it was developed, when it started, is that what a forensic examiner would do to look into the data to try to identify that other information?
Yes, you can see what other information is available. You can see if there's any information that's been deleted that can be recovered. You can validate the information that's there and make sure that the timestamps are being interpreted correctly and that they mean what you think they mean.
You told us you got a call from a consumer or a forensic examiner, Richard Green, about a timestamp. What type of timestamp? For what type of artifact was this timestamp?
It was related to an internet query.
And so there was an internet query on a phone that had a timestamp, and this gentleman, Mr. Green, had a question about it.
He did. He wanted to know how accurate the timestamp was in relation to when the internet query was made.
Okay. Did you look into the question, the query that was made?
In response to Richard Green at that time, I didn't. I wasn't aware that Richard Green had made this request until several months later. But it was an almost identical question that had been asked by the troopers here. And that's the question that I was able to look into and to answer.
And can you share with us what was the issue? What was the question that you were actually looking into?
The question was related to a timestamp of 2:27:40 a.m. And an internet query that appeared to have occurred at that time. There was no other information on the device that suggested that that internet query had occurred at that time. So we wanted to know how relevant is that timestamp to when the query happened. So I was able to take test devices, recreate test data to find out exactly what this timestamp meant, and discovered that it was actually the timestamp that the tab within the browser was brought into focus and had no relevance to when the actual web query had been made.
And so after you looked into the issue and came to a determination or opinion, did you reach back out to Mr. Green?
Eventually, yes, I did. After I'd provided information to the troopers, I wrote a blog that covered this information because there was another examiner in Europe who had a very similar question, and I realized that this is a relatively common point of confusion. And then eventually I reached out to Richard Green, offering to speak to him about this issue and clear up any confusion, but never received a response.
So to summarize, there was an inquiry about a phone that made a Google or a internet search. And the question is, what time was that search made?
Correct.
And relative to that inquiry, there was a timestamp on some of the data that said 2:27 a.m.
Correct.
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
So at some point, did you have an opportunity to forensically examine a telephone that was attributed to a person by the name of Jennifer McCabe?
I did have the opportunity to look at the data that was extracted from that device. I never saw the device itself.
I'm putting that aside for a second. Secondly, were you asked to look at any other phone to examine data in this case aside from the phone attributed to Jennifer McCabe?
Yes, I was also sent the extraction of data from John O'Keefe's phone.
Did you look through the data and analyze some of the data in John O'Keefe's phone?
I did, yes.
So I want to walk through both your analysis of Jennifer McCabe's phone, but also of John O'Keefe's phone. So if we can first start with Ms. McCabe's phone.
Yes.
Did you actually receive her phone?
I didn't, no. It was just a download of the extraction.
So how does that work?
The examiners here had done the extraction of the device, resulted in a large zip file, which is a container containing all of the files extracted from the phone. They uploaded it to Cellbrite's secure portal, where I was able to download it and verify what the data was in the extraction.
When you received the download of the extraction for Jennifer McCabe's phone, was it similar process for John O'Keefe's phone?
With John O'Keefe's phone, I actually received the data on a USB thumb drive through the mail.
And before we begin, can you summarize briefly the issue, what you were looking for, and what the scope was as far as Jennifer McCabe's phone?
For Jennifer McCabe's phone, it was related to the internet search that occurred, or that allegedly occurred, at 2:27:40.
And as part of your effort and analysis, did you put together a PowerPoint that would help educate us on how a timestamp works and what happened in this case regarding a search?
I did, yes.
And have you seen that PowerPoint recently?
I did, yes.
May I approach, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'm handing you a binder that you should take a look in. Do you know or do you recognize what's in that binder?
Yes, this is the PowerPoint presentation I created related to Jen's phone.
And with that presentation, do you have it downloaded on your computer?
I do, yes.
I'd like to introduce this as the next exhibit, please.
No objection, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
You know, with the court's permission, I'd ask Mr. Whiffen to be able to use his computer to walk us through the PowerPoint and explain it to the jury.
No objection, Your Honor.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Whiffen.
Okay.
May we begin, Your Honor?
Yes.
Mr. Whiffen, if you would walk us through and explain the PowerPoint and explain this issue to the jury, what the question was and how you resolved it.
Of course. Okay. The query revolved around a database called browserstate.db. Browserstate stores information about Safari internet browser and about the tabs that the user has either had open or has open. Fundamentally, in this presentation, I wanted to include information from iOS 14 and earlier. iOS 14 is not the version of iOS that was on Jen McCabe's phone, but iOS 14 has an easier way to understand how this database works. And then I can move on to iOS 15, which was the device or was the version installed on Jen McCabe's phone. And hopefully by that point, it will be clearer how this information is being populated on the device.
Could you tell us what iOS means?
iOS is Apple's proprietary operating system available on iPhones.
Thank you.
Fundamentally, the browserstate.db tabs table is shown, hopefully I can show this on here, in the top here. The real database has many more fields, but these are the fields which are important for the demonstration to just see the row ID, the timestamp that's recorded, the URL or the web address, and the title of the page. And the example at the side there, you can see there's the browser is open, but there is no tab actually in focus at this time.
Can I take us just a little bit back so we can put this in context?
Yes.
When you are doing internet searches on your phone and you hit Safari or Google or whatever search engine you're going to use, does it create a tab?
It doesn't create a tab just by opening the application, but there may be tabs already open in the background when you start the application, and then you can tell it to create further tabs.
So if I have a phone, can I have a number of different tabs on my phone at the same time if I've searched for different things throughout the day?
Correct. You can have hundreds of tabs open.
Do tabs stay open forever or can you close them?
They stay open until you close them.
So if you look at your phone and you have a number of different tabs, and say, for example, I start with one tab, I'm looking for the local football score. Can I reuse that same tab for some other search or do I have to use a new tab to start a new search?
You could use that tab for as long as you wanted. Or create a new tab to do additional searches while maintaining the original tab in its current state.
And so what you're trying to demonstrate to the jury is identifying a time on one of these tabs where a particular search was made.
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained as to form.
Could you explain this demonstration as it relates to tabs on these internet searches? What are we actually trying to learn?
So as I showed, there's a field in this table called timestamp. It's actually called last viewed timestamp. And I wanted to prove or to demonstrate what that timestamp means, how that timestamp gets populated, and how it's relevant or irrelevant to a case.
So if I have one or many tabs open on my phone, each tab will have its own timestamp?
Correct.
And the URL, that's whatever I look up, what I search on the search engine?
Objection, Your Honor.
I'll allow that. Is that what's looked at?
That's correct. The URL is the address of the page that's being viewed.
So if I have a tab open and I use it continuously, 3, 4, 5, 10 times, will the time stamp change?
No, it will not.
And is that what you're explaining to us now?
Correct. That's part of the demonstration and presentation.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
So in this instance, at 10 a.m., which is shown in the top of the device there, we can see I visit firstpage.com as an example website. At that time, a row is created in the database that shows row ID 1, with the timestamp 10 a.m. when the page was opened. The URL and the title are relevant to the page that was visited, so firstpage.com. A minute later, excuse me, I now use the same tab to visit secondpage.com. What actually happens in the database at this point in time is the first record is updated with new information. So we continue to see row ID 1. We continue to see the timestamp that the tab was opened at 10 a.m. And we now see the URL and the title that are related to the secondpage.com website. So I've shown it here. The first one is red to show that's no longer a live record. It's been replaced by the new record that's underneath it in black. A minute later again, I can visit thirdpage.com. And at that point, the record's updated a further time. So we still see that it's row ID 1, because no new ID, new rows are being created. We're just simply updating the existing rows. So we still have row ID 1. We still have 10 a.m. as the timestamp. And we have the URL and the title that show thirdpage.com instead.
Mr. Whiffen, so in the URL column, there are three different searches?
Yes, this is three different pages that have been visited within the same tab.
And in the data, it has three timestamps, but they're all the same?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
This database is not monitoring web navigation events. It's purely monitoring the tab events. So when the tab's brought into focus or when the tab's created is the only timestamp that's relevant here.
Thank you.
From a non-forensic point of view, if I was looking at this database in a regular database viewing tool, all I would see is the black record at the bottom. I wouldn't see the other two records because they've been essentially overwritten by the third record. If I was to use a forensic tool, though, then I would see all of these records because the forensic tool is designed to find the older versions of these records that have been replaced. So again, from a forensic point of view, I would see all of these records, I would see all the different URLs, and I would see the same timestamp and the same row ID for all of them. This fundamentally changed in iOS 15, and I've tested this on multiple versions of iOS 15, 16, 17, and 18, including iOS 15.2.1, which is the same version of iOS installed on Jen McCabe's phone. In this case, the data is not written to the database immediately. So I've tried to show here that we have some in-memory variables, so essentially a short-term memory that the device knows exist, but aren't written to the database yet. So they're not written long-term. So in this case, if at 10 a.m. I go to firstpage.com, we see that the in-memory variable for timestamp URL and title are updated to show a 10 a.m. timestamp and the firstpage.com information. But you can see at the bottom, I still have the browser state tabs table, and nothing has been written to that database at this time.
So can I ask you a question about this browser state DB? What does that mean? What does that tell us?
The browser state.db is just the name of the database that Apple are using to monitor the tab activity on the device.
Will a cell phone have a number of different databases it will send information to, or is it all one database?
There are hundreds or thousands of databases, depending on what applications are installed on the device. Each database typically targets a different application or a different feature.
Can information, like information from a URL or a Google search or a Safari search, can it leave data on different databases, or does it always go to one database?
It can leave on different databases, for sure.
Thank you.
So again, to continue this example, if I now go to secondpage.com a minute later, we can see that now the in-memory variable is updated. So the timestamp still remains 10 a.m., the same as it did previously on iOS 14, but the URL and the title are updated to reflect the current web page that's being viewed. Again, nothing has been written to the browser state database. I can go to thirdpage.com. Again, we see the in-memory variables for the URL and the title are updated, but the timestamp still remains the time that this tab was brought into focus or created, not the time that the navigational event occurred. Still, nothing's been written to the browser state database. And it's not until you actually close the tab that the information gets removed from the in-memory variables and written into the database. And at that point, the information written to the database is whatever was in the in-memory variable. So right now, all we have is a single record in the database that shows the 10 a.m. timestamp. That's when the tab was opened. And we have the thirdpage.com URL and title information, which is the most recent web page visited in that tab. It wouldn't matter whether I was looking at this data using a regular database tool or a forensic database tool. The only record that I will see is this particular record. There may be multiple versions of this record, but still would only show me this timestamp and this URL information, because this is the only information that was ever committed to the database. Okay, moving on from that, there was multiple databases or multiple data sources on Jen McCabe's phone that could be used to see what actually happened on the device at this time of day that was of interest. So the analysis I did looked at the browser state database that we've just described, the history database, which is what is tracking the navigational events. So every time you visit a website and the website fully loads, it gets written to the history database to say this database, this URL was visited at this time. And that's the information that as a user you can see. When you look at the internet history in your device, it will list all of the web pages that have been visited. com.applemobilesafari.plist is a property list file, so essentially a list of values and information, keys and values that would describe various settings on the device typically. But it also stores information such as the last searches that were conducted using the Safari search feature. And then finally here we've got knowledgec.db, which is a massive database at the heart of iOS that stores lots of types of information. It can tell you what web page was actually on the screen at any given time. It can tell you when the backlight came on, when the backlight went off, when the device was locked or unlocked, the battery level, lots of different types of information, but useful here for the web pages that were being viewed. So using the combination of all those sources, I could see that at 2:27:29 a.m., Safari was opened from the application library on the device. At 2:27:29 a.m., when Safari opened, there was already numerous tabs open in the background. The browser would show in the foreground whatever browser tab was opened when Safari was previously minimized. In this case, we can see, looking at knowledgec.db, that the web page that was being viewed was related to Hockomock Sports Friday's schedule scoreboard. At around 2:27:30, that tab would have been closed. Now, we don't actually have a time that the tab was closed, but based on other activity, this timestamp can be inferred. But essentially, when this tab was closed, a record is created in the browser state database that shows the timestamp 1:59:44 a.m. That would have been the tab at the time that the tab took focus, and then the Hockomock Sports Friday schedule scoreboard URL. At 2:27:31, there was a browser switch occurred, and the last visited timestamp that's held in memory would have taken the time that this occurred, so 2:27:31. This URL was PayPal. There was no navigational event listed in history, so this wasn't a page that was visited from a bookmark or from typing in a URL. It was whatever was currently shown in that tab when the tab was brought into focus. And we know that this exact URL was last visited at 7:40 a.m. on the 28th of January. This is evidenced in browser state and in knowledgec. Around a second later, that tab gets closed, and that record gets written to the database with a time of 2:27:31, because that's the time the tab was brought back into focus. It gets written with the URL and the title information related to PayPal. At 227.33, another tab is brought into focus from the background. This one related to Eastern Bank. Again, the last visited timestamp would be updated because this tab has now been brought into focus, causing the timestamp to change. We know that this particular website was visited at 8:02 on the 27th of January, and there's no new navigational events at this time. So we know it's just brought into focus and visible on screen according to KnowledgeC and browser state databases. That tab gets closed and it gets written to the database. This again is going to show, and I've just noticed there's a typo on here and the timestamp at the top is showing incorrectly. But essentially it's closed around this time and the Eastern Bank URL is written to the browser state database with the 227.33 timestamp. At 227.35, we see that there's a YouTube video shown on screen related to It's Raining Men. This shows in KnowledgeC, there's no new navigational event for it, but there's also no timestamp in the browser state database at this point. This is because this page is actually, or this tab, is brought back into focus a second time, and that when it gets brought into focus the second time, the timestamp that's attributed to it overwrites the timestamp that would have been written at this point. Sounds convoluted, but essentially, if you imagine that the in-memory timestamp here would have said 227.35, but then there's another tab that's brought into focus related to Hockomock Sports at 227.36.
Mr. Whiffen, can I ask you a couple questions?
Yes.
This timestamp 227.36, does that indicate the time when this tab was actually opened?
Yes. The time that the tab was brought into focus or opened.
What does it mean brought into focus?
If you imagine you could have five or six or however many tabs in the background, you select one of those tabs to view, it makes it full screen, that would be considered in focus, and that would cause the timestamp to be updated.
So if someone had an open tab that had a timestamp, and then they put it in the background to look at a different tab, but then went back to an earlier tab and opened it, would it create a new timestamp?
It would. It would update the timestamp.
If somebody had an open tab and they didn't put it in the background, but they used other functions or shut off the phone, and when they came back, that tab was still open, would that create a new timestamp?
As long as Safari doesn't close, then the timestamp will remain the same. So if I just minimize Safari, put it into the background, and start to do other things on my phone, the timestamp won't get updated. If I completely close Safari or turn the phone off, when Safari reloads, then that tab does get a new timestamp when it opens up again.
Thank you.
Okay. So at 227.36, we've got Hockomock Sports, Gallery Shoots, Canton Girls, Basketball to Important Win at Mansfield is the page that is visible on screen. Again, we know that there's no navigational event at this time, so the page is not being loaded as a result of a bookmark or typing the URL in. It's just showing what was on screen previously, and we know that this page was previously viewed at 22:55 on the 27th of January. This tab gets closed and gets written to the database as well, and we see it's written with the timestamp 227.36 when the tab was brought into focus. And then we go back to the YouTube video tab. So at this point, the timestamp that had been written there gets overwritten again with 227.38. And it shows the YouTube video is the active page that's on the screen. At around 227.39, that tab gets closed and the record is written to the database showing a timestamp of 227.38 when the tab took focus and the YouTube video URL. Then we move to 227.40, which was the time of interest. And we see that a browser switch occurs, causing the last visited timestamp to take on the time of 227.40. This is the tab that was ultimately used to search Hoss Long to Die in Cold, which is the query that started all of the confusion. At this point in time, there is no navigational events recorded anywhere. All we see is that the web page that was brought into view is ozonebasketball.com/teams. This webpage was last visited at 14 minutes after midnight on the 26th of January. We know that this is on screen because it tells us that in Knowledge C, and we know that the time is 2:27:40 based on Knowledge C timestamps and based on the browser state database timestamp. At 2:27:42, there is a web navigation event. Whether this is loaded from a bookmark or whether it's typed in, I can't say. But a web navigation event occurs using the same tab that's just been loaded. And now the user is loading the web page, hockamocksports.com/standings. This is logged in the history database that shows what web page is visited when. And it also shows in the Knowledge C database to show what web page is on screen at this time.
Mr. Whiffen, in the slide before 2:27:40, you mentioned that was the tab in question.
Yes.
Do the following pages that you show us in the PowerPoint follow that one specific tab?
Yes.
Thank you.
So at 2:27:47, there's another web navigation event as the web page hockamocksports.com/schedules is loaded. Again, this is evidenced in the history database to show that a navigation event occurred and completed, and in Knowledge C to show that this is the web page that was viewable on screen. At 2:27:53, there's a further web navigation event where we're now viewing the, or now loading the page hockamocksports.com/schedules/girls hockey. Again, this is evidenced in the history database and the Knowledge C database to show what page loaded and what page was visible on screen. At 2:27:58, there's a further navigation event for girls hockey Franklin 21-22. Again, this is logged as a navigational event in the history database and shown on screen according to the Knowledge C database.
So I understand these are all subsequent searches on the same open tab.
Correct.
Your Honor.
Are these?
Sustained as to form.
Are these all subsequent searches on the same single open tab?
There is no tab switch event listed. We see the tab switch event occur at 2:27:40, and then we see lots of navigational events occur.
Thank you.
At 2:28:06, Safari is minimized. So it's removed from focus so that something else could be viewed, or you know, the phone is locked.
Is removed from focus different than closing?
Correct. If you remove it from focus, it's essentially going into the background, but it's still open. It's in its current state, just in the background, versus if you close it completely and have to reload it later on. So in this particular state, the timestamp doesn't get changed. The timestamp remains 2:27:40 as it was earlier. Safari is then not used again until 6:23:37, when it's opened from the background using the icon in the app library. At this point, when it loads up, the same page that was open when Safari was minimized is shown. So we still see hockamocksports.com/schedules/girls hockey/Franklin/2021-2022. There's no navigational event at this point, so we know that it wasn't completely reloaded. It's just showing what was on screen previously, and it's evidenced in the Knowledge C database. At 6:23:49, there's a cache file created. The cache file is related to how long to digest food. Now, these particular cache files show up as suggestions in Safari. So as you're typing in a query or a word or a URL, for example, Safari tries to take that information and make suggestions based on what it thinks you might be searching for. So if, for example, you were to type in how long to die with the word spelled just D-I, Safari can mistake that for how long to digest food, and it could present this information. And up until about 12 months ago, this is the information that was provided by Safari. If you were to do this search, if you were to type in how long to DI, you would get the result that's shown at the top of the screen with an image of somebody eating a plate of food. And this is the image that was cached onto Jim McCabe's phone at 6:23:49.
What does cache mean?
Essentially, downloaded now for use later. It will download it, it will save it in case it's required again. If it is, it doesn't need to download it, it's already there. If it's not required again, eventually it will be deleted.
So is it stored information from prior events that's available in case the device thinks you're looking for it?
Yes, so at this point in time, at 6:23:49, when it downloaded it, that's the first time that it's downloaded this image and it stores it. If an hour later, for example, I did the same search a second time, it wouldn't need to re-download the image because it's already got it in cache. So this, the creation time of this image shows that this is the first time that this cache file was downloaded. A few seconds later, at 6:23:51, the blue button at the bottom of the keyboard is used to submit a search for the term "how long tidai in kikdi," C-I-K-D. This creates a specific URL in Safari, which is shown on screen here. So google.com/search how long tidai in kikdi, i.e. UTF-8, OE UTF-8. Client Safari is the important part of this string that tells us that it's a query that's made using Safari. This is different to if I visited Google, for example, and just typed in the search text box in Google. It wouldn't necessarily have this same structure of the URL. So we know that this is the query created by submitting a search using the search bar here and pressing the blue button at the bottom. We know that that search was conducted at 6:23:51 according to the information in mobilesafari.plist. And knowledge C also shows that this page was visible. Importantly, there is no history record made that shows that a navigation actually occurred to this to this website. Several reasons why that might happen. One could be if the device was in private browsing mode. However, it can't have been in private browsing mode because if it was, we wouldn't have the search recorded in the Mobile Safari plist either. So we know it wasn't in private browsing. It could have been deleted at some point after the fact. That would leave a gap in the numbering. Every time a record is written, it would be consistent numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And to delete a number would leave a gap there, so you would see 1, 2, 4, 5, and that number will pretty much never be reused. So if you don't see a gap, then you can be confident that nothing was deleted, and there are no gaps on this device. The third reason, and the one that I believe is the reason why it wasn't recorded in the database, is that the page never completely loaded. If I go to a web page and cancel the navigation prior to it completing the load, it will never get written to the history database. At 6:24:18, there's a second search submitted using the same method, so still using the Safari search bar, this time searching for host long to die in cold. This is evidenced in the mobilesafari.plist. Again, there is no record made in the history database that to me suggests that the page never successfully loaded. At 6:24:24, Safari is minimized again. It gets reopened at 10:33:33 a.m., again loaded from the app library and brought into focus. And at that point, the previous page is shown to the user. That previous page is related to the search host long dying cold. This is evidence in knowledge C to show that this is the page that's visible on screen, but there is still no history event that shows that the page completely loaded. And at around that time, so around 10:33:34, that tab would have been closed, resulting in the record being written to the browser state database with the timestamp 2:27:40. When that tab was originally brought into focus several hours earlier, but it shows the most recent URL information, which is the Google search for host long to die in the cold. It doesn't have any of the other URL information that was visited during that time period. It doesn't have the previous Google search for how long to die in the kikdi, because all it records is the most recent URL that's visited alongside the original time that the tab took focus. Importantly here, there is no title information. The title information is included within the page itself. So if you do a Google search, the title of the page that showed up would show Google search, and then it would show the query that you typed in to search for. The fact that this doesn't have a title also suggests that the page never loaded. So again, it kind of ties back to the fact that it's not written in the history database. We have no title. It's both indicative that the page never successfully loaded.
Mr. Whiffen, when a tab is ultimately closed, does the URL always have the last search, or could it show an earlier search?
It will always be whatever URL is visible in the tab at the time.
Thank you.
To overview again the data sources used here, com.applemobilesafari.plist is known to be a reliable location to get search timestamps from. We know that it's good to show the time that a search was conducted and what search was conducted. It doesn't record if the device is in private browsing mode. The only time it shows how long to die in the kickd is at 6:23:51, and the only time it shows how long to die in the cold is at 6:24:18. There's no other mentions of either of these searches anywhere else in this file. The history database, again, is known to be a good source of data for visited web pages and timestamps for the pages that completely loaded. Again, in this case, neither of these searches or neither of these URLs was in the history database, but there are no missing records, which indicates that nothing was deleted. And again, the only reason that I can come up with for why that is the case is that the page didn't load. There must be an entry within this database to allow the user to delete it. Obviously, if the page doesn't load, it doesn't get written to the history. As a user, you can't see that item in your internet history list, so you can't delete it. And then knowledge C, which shows the page that's on the screen when the browser is in use. Again, we know that this is a good timestamp. And we see the only times that web pages related to these web searches were open is at 6:23 and at 10:33. There were multiple deleted records in the browser state database. It wasn't just the record for host long to die in the cold.
When you say there's multiple deleted records, can you go into a database and see what URL searches have been deleted from the actual item?
Yes, so from a forensic examiner point of view and using forensic software, I can look at the database and see the records that have been deleted and recovered. There does become a time when you're unable to recover any more records and they're now just purely deleted and unable to get back. But at this point, I was able to recover a good number of records. And these were the five that I thought it was important to focus on. For here. You can see that three of them occur at 227. So at 227.36, 227.38, 227.40. And these are the web pages that we've just seen in the presentation. So Hockamock Sports, the YouTube video, How Long to Die in the Cold. And then two additional pages for CantonMA.org and Ozone Basketball. The way that we're able to recover these records forensically is because of how databases work. What I've tried to display here is that when you first create a record, in this case creating record 4025, a new page is created in the database. A page is simply a block of binary data that's organized in a way that can be understood by the database as a page of data, much like it would be a ledger with a list of records. So it creates frame 181 with page 2752 and the record 4025. What is a little bit different from if you were doing this manually is when you want to add a new record, or when you want to delete a record, or when you want to update a record, it has to create an entirely new page or an entirely new version of that page. So in this case, we see that frame 194 is also page 2752. It duplicates the record 4025 and adds the record 4026. From the database's point of view at this time, frame 181 is now dead, like it won't be used for anything. And a regular database tool would only refer to the most recent version of that page, so frame 194. Forensically, I can look back at all of these different versions of the page and I can start to see differences. Not so important in this case when all that's happening is that you're adding information, but when you start to delete or edit records, being able to go backwards and see these previous pages, you can see the records that have been changed or deleted. So as we're moving along all of these pages, each of these refer to a time when a new record was added. Every time a new record is added, a new frame is created, it duplicates the page from before, and it adds the new record. I've highlighted record 4028 in green across these three frames because this is the Host Long to Die in Cold record that is of interest. Moving forward again, we continue to see records being added, but particularly here at frame 430, record 4029 is deleted. 4029, if I go back a few slides, we can see 4029 is the CantonMA.org Families Index webpage. As far as I know, no relevance to anything related to this case. It just so happens this is the first record deleted from the browser state database. We don't have information that tells us at what time the record's deleted, but we're able to infer what time that record was deleted based on other records in this frame. So for example, we know that at the time that record 4029 was deleted, record 4031 already existed. Record 4031 has a timestamp of 6:29 on the 31st of January. Therefore, we can summarize that record 4029 had to be deleted at some point after 6:29 on the 31st of January. We see again record 4030 is deleted on frame 468. Again, we can look at what record was the most recently created on that frame at the point that that record was deleted. And that gives us information that suggests record 4030 had to have been deleted at some point after 8:35 on the 31st of January. We can continue to go along and continue to see that records being added, edited, and deleted. But the record of interest, 4028, still exists, even on frame 650. And in fact, it doesn't get deleted until frame 732. By the time the record related to Host Long Died in the Cold is deleted, record 4037 already exists. Record 4037 was created after 2207 on the 31st of January. Therefore, we know that the Host Long to Die in the Cold record was deleted at some point after 10 p.m. on the 31st of January. Taking all of those deleted records, those five deleted records, and the earliest time that they could have possibly been deleted, we see a spread throughout the 31st of January. A few quite early on at 6:29 and 8:35, a couple at 9:20, 9:40, and then finally the one that we're interested in at 2207. For the user to cause these to be deleted, if you wanted to do it selectively and delete one at a time, the record has to be available in the history database. As I said earlier, it wasn't ever in the history database because there'd be a gap. So this record could not have been deleted by the user selectively. That leaves options of deleting everything from the history, but if everything was deleted, we would have none of this information, and we do. And it also leaves the option of deleting everything from what's considered today and everything that's considered today and yesterday. And again, if either of those options were the case, we'd have much less information than what we have, and we wouldn't see this staggering of timestamps that we see here where the information was deleted. Ultimately, I wasn't able to say what caused these deletions at these particular times, but I'm confident that it wasn't as a result of user interaction, that something that was brought on purpose.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.